This episode is based on a chapter from Laws of Life, Book 2. Now Build the System for Your Life by Jack Spirko. Chapter 8, If You Cheat, It Should Benefit You.
And it is definitely a chapter that challenges some deeply held beliefs.
Well, absolutely. So to start us off, I want you to imagine you are running a marathon, you're exhausted, sweating, you are completely hitting the wall.
Right, just totally gassed.
Exactly. Now, if you cut across a park to shave a mile off the course, society calls you a cheater.
Which is accurate.
But if you just step off the course entirely, sit on a park bench, eat a jelly donut, and quit.
People call that cheating on your diet.
Yes. But today, in this deep dive, we are going to prove why one of those actions makes you a villain and the other just makes you a failure.
And framing that distinction incorrectly is, well, it's likely costing you opportunities and, frankly, leverage in ways you haven't even realized yet.
Welcome to the deep dive. I spend my days as a professional ethics and decision-making coach. My entire job is helping my clients separate actual enforceable rules from social pressure, self-sabotage, and, you know, the comforting lies we tell ourselves to justify playing small.
And sitting across the table, my background is in career strategy and negotiation mentoring. So I teach professionals how to use things like timing, leverage, and legal advantages to accelerate their trajectories without, you know, crossing their own ethical boundaries.
Because the traditional system is meticulously designed to keep you moving at the slow, predictable speed of the herd.
Exactly. Which makes us a pretty perfect duo to tackle our mission for this deep dive. We are unpacking Jack Spirko's core law here, which is, and I quote, "If it didn't benefit you, it wasn't cheating. It was failure."
It is a highly provocative statement.
It is. And we have two major objectives to hit as we dissect this. First, we have to recalibrate how you use the word cheat. Because misusing it actually programs your mental operating system to embrace failure.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Right. And second, we have to unpack a very uncomfortable truth. Cheating is wildly subjective to the observer. What looks like a dirty trick to the herd is often just a highly optimized route to success.
And the text sets this up brilliantly with two really iconic pop culture references. First, you've got Sun Tzu's timeless advice from The Art of War, which says the skillful fighter puts themselves in a position where defeat is impossible. You basically win before the battle even starts.
Right. Positioning is everything.
And then there is Captain Kirk from Star Trek. When Kirk is accused of cheating on the Kobayashi Maru, which is that intentionally unwinnable Academy training scenario, he doesn't apologize.
No, he just says, "I changed the conditions of the test."
Exactly. I changed the conditions of the test.
But to change the conditions of the test in your own life, you have to understand the mechanics of the test itself.
Okay.
We have to strip the emotion away from the concept of cheating and look at its raw definition.
Let's start with diet culture, because that is where the word is most frequently butchered. The author brings up a point made by Maria Emmerich in a carnivore diet documentary.
Oh, right. The junk food example.
Yeah. She points out that if you are following a strict diet protocol to heal your body and you cave in and eat a bunch of junk food, you didn't cheat. Why? Because eating that junk food provided absolutely zero benefit to your biological goal.
I mean, you didn't hack the matrix. You didn't find some secret loophole that allowed you to lose weight while eating garbage.
Right.
You simply demonstrated a lack of discipline. You failed.
Let's look at the character Bill from the text. So Bill sets a 90-day fitness goal. 3 weeks into it, a friend invites him out, and Bill decides to skip the gym. He says, "I've earned a cheat day. I'm going out for beers."
He slaps the label cheat day on it.
Exactly. He dresses up a failure as a reward. This goes right back to our marathon analogy. Taking a shortcut across the park breaks a written rule to gain a competitive advantage. That is mechanical cheating.
But sitting on a bench, eating a donut while your competitors run by is just self-sabotage.
Yep.
Well, let's look at an example of genuine mechanical cheating to contrast with Bill. The author shares this hilarious story from his 1980s high school computer class.
Oh, this one was great.
It was essentially a typing course, and the core rule was that you had to physically type out your own code. The teacher was actively monitoring the room to ensure kids weren't, you know, handing their physical floppy disks to one another to copy files.
Right, the teacher was guarding against the technology they understood.
Precisely. But the author figured out the keyboard shortcuts. Control-C and Control-V, copy and paste.
The ultimate cheat code of the 80s.
Seriously. So he brokers a deal with a classmate. The classmate does the physical typing, the author uses a split second to copy and paste the work onto his own disk, and in exchange, and this is the best part, he pays the classmate in homemade deer jerky.
He literally traded deer jerky for an A grade with zero effort.
Zero effort.
So let's run that through the ethics filter. Did it break an established enforceable rule? Yes. Was there a risk of penalty if caught?
Definitely.
Yes. But did it deliver a tangible, measurable benefit to the person breaking the rule? Absolutely. It meets the strict definition of cheating.
And this raises a fascinating psychological puzzle. If actual cheating requires gaining a real advantage, why do we constantly apply the word to our own self-inflicted losses? Why do we look in the mirror and say, well, you're only cheating yourself?
Okay, here is where it gets really interesting. As an ethics coach, I unpack this specific trauma with clients constantly. It stems directly from early childhood compliance programming.
Oh, like the lies we tell kids.
Exactly. Think about the absurd lies adults invent to control children without having to explain complex reasoning. The classic threat that if you pee in the swimming pool, a chemical will turn the water pink and expose you.
Or telling a child that turning on the interior dome light of the car while driving at night is a federal crime that will get the parents arrested.
I totally believe that one. Or the ultimate surveillance state myth, which is Santa Claus is watching your every move, so you better fall in line. We are conditioned with these phantom rules to make us docile.
And the most damaging phantom rule of all is that old cliche that cheaters never win.
Yes. That phrase is just a pacifier for the obedient. The text shatters this by pointing out a reality we all know. Cheaters win constantly.
They really do.
Look at pro athletes using undetectable designer drugs. They reap the benefits of the steroids, pass the drug tests, and take home championship rings.
So by clinging to the myth that cheaters never win, and then categorizing our own laziness as cheating, we corrupt our decision-making software.
How so?
Well, when your brain hears the word cheat, it subconsciously expects a reward. So when you say, I cheated on my diet, your brain gets confused. It thinks it won something. If you forcefully relabeled it and said, I failed today because I chose momentary comfort over my long-term goal.
Ouch.
Right. The psychological sting of that would actually prompt behavior modification.
That makes total sense. Well, let's push this into more controversial territory. We have established that real cheating requires breaking written rules for a benefit. But what happens when an action stays perfectly within the written rules, but completely violates the so-called spirit of the game?
Now we enter the gray area of bending rules and the subjectivity of the observer. The author tells a story about a martial arts tournament. In this specific style, competitors were forbidden from kicking the knee joint, but delivering a brutal thigh kick at Charlie Horse was not a disqualification.
What was the penalty?
It was merely a penalty that cost you half a point.
In a match where the first fighter to 3 points wins. Right.
So a particular team developed a really brutal strategy. The moment the match started, their fighter would intentionally drop a devastating kick right into their opponent's thigh. They gladly accepted the half point penalty.
Oh.
But the result was their opponent hobbling, cramping, and losing all mobility for the remainder of the short 2-minute match. Technically, it was within the boundaries of the rules. They simply treated the penalty as a purchase price for an overwhelming advantage.
Okay, I have to throw a massive ethical flag on the play here. As a decision-making coach, that crosses a severe line. You aren't just finding a clever loophole. You are intentionally inflicting physical harm and exploiting a safety rule. That borders on malice. How can we possibly justify that as a valid strategy?
I get that. But from a pure strategy perspective, the rulebook priced the action. If a sport determines that an action is dangerous enough to warrant disqualification, they make it a disqualifying foul.
That's true.
By pricing it at half a point, the governing body categorized it as a minor infraction. You might find it distasteful, but they played the game that actually existed on the mat, not the polite version you wish existed.
I see the mechanics of it, but it just feels like a race to the bottom.
Well, let's look at a scenario that doesn't involve physical injury.
Yeah.
The author played a paintball game called poker. It is a massive free-for-all. Every player starts with a random playing card. When you shoot someone, they are eliminated, and you take their card.
And the best hand wins.
Right. The player with the best 5-card poker hand at the end wins the pot. Mm. Total chaos. So the author spots a brand new player, a complete rookie who looks terrified.
Okay.
Before the starting whistle, he pulls the kid aside and proposes an alliance.
Yeah.
He says, let's watch each other's backs, survive the melee, and pool our cards at the end to split the money.
Oh, that's nice.
The kid eagerly agrees. They take up back-to-back defensive positions. The whistle blows to start the game, and the author immediately pivots and shoots the kid point blank, taking his card.
Okay, again, that is ruthless. You're betraying a beginner who trusted you. If that isn't cheating, what is?
Look at the name of the game, poker. In standard poker, or liar's poker, played with dollar bill serial numbers, deception isn't a violation.
Right.
It is the fundamental mechanism of play. There was no written rule against alliances or breaking them. Bluffing a rookie was a known, unwritten tactic among the veterans. The author didn't break a rule. He utilized an angle.
The psychological fallout of that is fascinating, though. The rookie undoubtedly felt cheated, even if no rule was broken. And this subjectivity translates directly into the professional world. The hurt, you know, the people who meticulously follow every unwritten social rule develop intense resentment toward anyone who bypasses the cue.
Oh, absolutely. The author experienced this in the early days of podcasting. Traditional media gatekeepers and critics were furious.
Because he was successful.
Yes. And they accused him of cheating because he didn't have a broadcasting degree and hadn't spent a decade fetching coffee at a terrestrial radio station. He bypassed the suffering they believed was mandatory.
And this resentment is perfectly encapsulated in the story of the Family Commission. Let's unpack the psychology of that story because it is the ultimate example of herd mentality.
Yeah. So the author was around 28 years old, no college degree. He had spent his early 20s as a bouncer, an army mechanic, busting tires, just hustling through different industries.
Right, doing odd jobs.
He's having a conversation with a family member who did everything by the traditional book, got a degree, secured a stable, predictable government job. During the chat, the author casually mentions he is finalizing a telecom data center deal that will yield a personal commission of $45,000 to $60,000.
Wait, in 1999?
Yes.
That single commission check was likely equivalent to the family member's entire annual salary.
Exactly. And the reaction is incredibly telling. The family member doesn't congratulate him. He gets visibly angry, shuts down, and aggressively changes the subject to whatever sport is playing on the television.
Wow.
To that family member, the author's success felt deeply unfair. It felt like cheating.
Because if a 28-year-old with no degree can make 60 grand in a single afternoon by hustling, it means the family member's rigid adherence to the slow, miserable, traditional path wasn't a law of physics. It was a choice.
It's entirely optional.
The sunk cost fallacy hits them like a freight train. The herd invents phantom rules like you need a degree to earn big money because enforcing conformity is infinitely easier than competing with outliers. The warning for you, the listener, is absolute. Never limit your own potential by waiting to qualify in the eyes of people who are committed to moving slowly.
Which transitions us perfectly to the ultimate arena for leveraging advantages without asking for permission, the job market. This is where my career strategy clients usually have their biggest epiphanies. But first, we have to recognize a massive trap that the herd falls into.
The repetition trap.
Yes, the meat counter worker analogy. Think about a deli worker. You ask for a pound of honey ham, they slice the stack, toss it on the scale, and it hits exactly 16.0 ounces on the very first try.
It looks like magic.
It does, but it's just the result of performing the exact same micro movement thousands of times.
Yeah.
The universal truth is that you will always become highly proficient at whatever you spend your time doing.
And the danger is becoming a master of something entirely useless to your future. If you spend 40 hours a week mindlessly scanning barcodes or filing paperwork, you are just refining a skill that traps you in that exact job.
Exactly. The text categorizes four distinct reasons people take jobs. First, pure survival. You just need money to eat. Second, taking the highest pay available for your current limited skill set.
What's the third?
Third is what the author calls a class three job, taking a role specifically to advance your life goals, build a network, or extract a specific experience. And fourth, doing what you genuinely love.
If we want to use the job market as a tool rather than a trap, we have to look at the process of acquiring those jobs. Most people view a job interview as a terrifying judgment day where a company decides if you are worthy.
That mindset gives away all your power. An interview is practice. If you want to become a formidable negotiator in business, you have to practice sitting across a table from someone who holds resources. You should apply for and go on every interview you can secure, even for roles you have zero intention of accepting.
Now, if you're listening to this, you might be thinking, wait a minute, isn't going on an interview for a job I don't want a massive waste of the employer's time? Isn't that unethical? Let's address that.
It is a mutual exchange of data. The company is practicing their culling techniques on you, refining their own psychological profiles of candidates. You are providing them with a data point while extracting negotiation experience. A prime example of this corporate culling is the SALT test.
Oh, I love this story. It completely reveals the hidden mechanics of executive hiring.
So the author was hiring for a senior corporate recruiting position with a salary around $180,000. After weeks of interviews, he had narrowed a stack of 50 resumes down to two exceptional finalists.
A dead tie on paper.
Completely. So he takes both candidates to a final lunch interview. The food arrives. One candidate immediately grabs the salt shaker and salts his meal. The other candidate takes a bite, evaluates the flavor, and then adds salt.
And the author hired the candidate who tasted it first.
Without hesitation. Because at a $180,000 executive level, you cannot afford a leader who acts on blind assumptions. Salting food before tasting it demonstrates a hardwired habit of applying solutions before gathering data on the actual problem.
That is brilliant. To the candidate who lost, that might seem like an invisible, unfair rule. But that is how the real game is played at the top level.
Once you understand how these mechanics work, you can find the pressure points. You can find where you actually hold leverage.
Where is that?
The point of absolute maximum leverage you will ever hold over a corporation is the tiny window of time after they have extended a formal job offer, but before you have formally accepted it. Think about the psychology. They have spent weeks interviewing. They have rejected everyone else. The hiring manager has emotionally committed to you as the solution to their headache.
They do not want to start the search over.
Exactly. The author demonstrates this with a story about being recruited by a chief marketing officer who held a Stanford MBA. She wanted him for a specific role. He knew he held the card, so he casually mentioned that while the job was appealing, the daily commute was geographically undesirable for his lifestyle.
He didn't demand anything, right? He just introduced a friction point.
Right, and the CMO immediately countered by offering him 2 days a week of remote work before he'd even formally interviewed with the broader team. He locked in a massive lifestyle concession simply by understanding his leverage. When you approach jobs this way, using them to get paid while you learn new skills, using interviews to practice negotiation, and observing your competitors on the company's dime, a job ceases to be a grind. It becomes a legitimate legal cheat code for your life.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground here. We've defined what real cheating is versus failure. We've explored how the herd uses phantom rules to shame outliers. We've looked at how to ruthlessly extract value from the job market.
Yeah, we've gone deep.
But how do you practically integrate this without losing your moral compass? How do you know when you are utilizing a valid cheat code versus just becoming an unethical shark? The text provides a definitive framework for this called the EDG method.
Let's break down EDGE. It's a sequential process. The E stands for examine the situation.
And this requires separating the rules of any situation into three distinct layers. First, the real rules. These are the written, enforceable laws or contractual obligations. Second, the social rules. This is the herd's expectation of how you should behave.
Right, the unwritten stuff.
Exactly. And third, the phantom rules. Think of phantom rules like an invisible electric fence for a dog. The owner takes the shock collar off, unplugs the fence, but the dog still refuses to cross the property line because of past conditioning.
It's a great analogy.
That is what childhood programming does to your ambition. You have to intellectually unplug the fence to see where your freedom actually lies.
And once you've mapped those layers, you move to the D. Decide your line.
This is where personal ethics come into play. You don't let society draw your boundary, but you also don't become a sociopath. You have to ask a defining question. What does winning look like here? You define your own ethical boundary based on your values, and you refuse to let the herd guilt you into shrinking that boundary.
Which brings us to the G, gain the advantage. You've examined the real rules. You've firmly established your ethical line. Now, operate aggressively within that space. Take the angle. Negotiate harder than polite society expects.
Mm-hmm.
Demand the remote work. Stop waiting for a gatekeeper to hand you a credential.
Seize the advantage that the rest of the herd is too domesticated to touch.
Exactly. And the final step, the second E, evaluate the outcome. This requires brutal, unflinching honesty. Did the action actually benefit you? If it did, analyze it and repeat it.
But if it harmed your long-term goals, if you betrayed your own standards for a quick thrill, you must call it a failure. Do not call it cheating yourself. Honest evaluation is the only way to upgrade your system.
Well said. Let's synthesize everything we've discussed into a really student-friendly recap for you. We're dealing with three distinctly different categories of action. Category one is real cheating. This requires breaking an actual established rule, taking on the risk of punishment, and walking away with a tangible, measurable benefit.
It's effective in the short term, but carries devastating long-term costs to your reputation and trust network.
Right. Category two is fake cheating. This is when you succumb to laziness, abandon your discipline for momentary comfort, actively harm your own goals, and then slap the word cheat on it to avoid taking accountability for your failure. It is pure self-sabotage wrapped in a coping mechanism.
And category three is legitimate cheat codes. These are highly effective, completely legal, and entirely ethical accelerators. Things like using interviews purely for negotiation practice or leveraging a corporate job to get paid while you learn a skill you plan to use for your own business later.
These strategies deeply unsettle the herd because they bypass traditional suffering, but they are the hallmark of top performers.
To permanently lock this paradigm shift into your mind, the author provides three specific lines of mental code. I want you to literally program these into your mental computer. Computer, treat herd expectations as background noise and keep me focused on what actually helps me.
That's powerful.
Computer, when I question an action run query, what does winning look like here?
Essential question.
Computer, when comfort tempts me, remind me that discipline is a hard today for an easy tomorrow.
If you are ready to stop playing by the phantom rules and want to dive deeper into frameworks that actually build leverage, there is a wealth of advanced material waiting for you at jackslaws.com. The mechanics we broke down today are just the foundation of building an unbreakable system for your life.
So make sure you visit jackslaws.com to explore those resources.
Yeah.
And I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We spent today talking about written rules versus phantom rules, but consider this.
Okay.
As artificial intelligence accelerates and begins automating massive sectors of the economy, the traditional real rules of career advancement are being rewritten overnight. When the ground shifts that dramatically, will you be the person paralyzed by the phantom rules of how things used to be done?
Or will you be the first one to find the new cheat codes?
Ensure you are always the one who changes the conditions of the test.